Hey there, welcome to In Full Color, a podcast on race, community, and justice. I'm Taylor McGee, your host, and today I'm sitting down with Mariam Hassoun, an incoming graduate student at the University of Oxford and founder of the Baraka English School. Mariam explains how language informs her identity as an Iraqi American and reflects on leading and participating in interfaith conversations. Hope you enjoy. To start off, if you could please tell me who you are, what you do, and how do you identify racially and or ethnically?
Cool. So my name is Mariam Hassoun. I am an Iraqi American. I am an incoming master's student in comparative and international education at the University of Oxford. I'm also the founder of Baraka English School in Iraq, which offers weekly English courses to orphans in Baghdad. I guess, identify within the MENA category, the Middle East, North African category, specifically as an Iraqi.
Okay, awesome. So I guess, can you share more about what your experience has been like as an Iraqi American and how you've integrated your cultural heritage and your nationality into life in America?
Yeah. So I've had a kind of funny upbringing in that sense. When my parents first moved here, I was about 6 months old, and they moved to New York City, where we were very much, my brother and I were very much immersed on my dad's side of the family. So very much surrounded by Muslim, Iraqi persons, very much kind of immersed in that culture, a lot of people like us. And then when we were still in elementary school, my parents made the move to Huntsville, Alabama, which was quite the paradigm shift, if you can imagine, because we all of a sudden kind of were not surrounded by anybody like us at all. And so I think throughout my life, my kind of interactions with my identity have really shifted. When I first got to Alabama, I rejected the culture here. Like I wouldn't say y'all. I felt just like it was all very kind of antithetical to the way that I had been raised and the way that I was accustomed to experiencing life in New York City, surrounded by so many relatives, really. But I think over time, I'm thankful to have kind of let go of some of the angst, I guess, towards the, contradictions in identity. I mean, at this point, I've been living in the South for, 13, 14 years. And so I think now I have a much healthier relationship with both kind of like my American identities and Iraqi identities. I've been trying to cook more Iraqi food and like speak Arabic with my family more, stuff like that, that has just been more kind of an intentional move to maintain a little bit of everything in my life. So
sure. Yeah. I really like what you were saying about how the moving from New York City to Alabama was this kind of paradigm shift, because it just the contrast of urban and like suburban rural, but also just like North versus South and the different cultural and political attitudes towards Arab and Muslim culture is very different. And so do you remember having to a certain different kind of consciousness that you had once you entered different spaces of when you were saying how having to reconcile with, okay, this is or being resistant to typical Southern American things and also trying to stay in touch with your culture? Was there any kind of push and pull of that growing up, or do you feel like it just depended on the kind of spaces that you were in?
Yeah, I mean, I think it did depend on the spaces that I was in. I think I this summer have like read some about code switching, and I definitely feel like that's applicable to my life. Especially, I don't know, sometimes I think about my like physical home with my nuclear family and just how particular of a space that is. In that we, I think, very much have this hybrid culture at this point of Iraqi American. I think for me, in many ways, it has meant that my culture has become intensely personal, partially because there just aren't that many people who I have in my life who have shared this particular kind of experience with. I definitely think that what I'm most familiar with maybe is educating people kind of on, especially in Huntsville, about being Muslim or like being Arab or what does that mean? I think that throughout my life, I didn't even realize till kind of recently just how much I explained. And you know, I don't necessarily think that that's a bad thing, so long as the explanation is brought on by curiosity and not ignorance or bigotry. But I think that being like one of the only like types of person, like with my specific demographic kind of criteria, in where I am in Alabama, definitely meant that there was a lot of explanation, which can feel exhausting at times.
What role does language play in your life and navigating, okay, am I going to speak Arabic or am I going to speak English? Did that have any kind of impact on how you saw yourself and your family and community?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'll give like a little background about this is like a very important question to me because I wrote my thesis about how English is taught in Iraq actually, and I'm pretty critical, I think, of just how much I think English is its role is kind of overemphasized in some ways, I guess I would say. Especially in other countries, in a way that kind of devalues kind of native language and culture. And I personally, like, I care a lot about studying language. This summer I spent 2 months studying Persian. I've taken Spanish for most of my life as well, and so language is just something that's like very, very, I think everybody should attempt to learn at least a second language. I think it's something that Americans don't tap into enough, don't value enough, because everywhere, pretty much most places in the world are expected to learn English, and we're expected to be able to kind of gallivant wherever we want without fear of not being understood. I thought a lot about how my relationship with Arabic is kind of unique to that with Spanish and Persian, which I've dedicated time studying. In that, I think with Arabic, like the language is very much wrap. My identity is kind of linked to my knowledge of Arabic in some ways, and I think at times I've felt very insecure about it. Like insecure in that, in Arabic we say like, if your language is mkesser, it's kind of like it's like broken. And I think for a long time I felt like my knowledge of Arabic just I didn't have the fluency that I wanted to. I use it to speak with my family, and I think it's really important that I learned it to the extent that I can be conversational and comfortable with it, but I don't know if I'm confident. And I think that's in part because there are a lot of expectations kind of wrapped around my knowledge of the language that at times have been challenging for me in terms of I think everyone kind of expects some sort of level. Like they're surprised or like, oh, it's pretty good, or like they're disappointed, it's not good enough, or and I think that the expectation really partially for myself and partially from others at times, have really struggled with.
What kind of connections do you feel are lost and not being able to speak like your native mother tongue? Because I think that's like not something that in America we have a concept of, because there's like you said, there's a cultural expectation for everyone else to be fluent in English. Could you elaborate more on why language is so important to you?
Sure. I mean, I'll like give a little like a kind of funny anecdote, but when we first got our green cards, my parents hadn't gone back to the Middle East since they left Iraq in the 90s, and they still at the time didn't feel safe returning to Iraq, so we first went to Turkey and met up with my aunt and my grandmother there. And my brother and I at the time, I think we were very kind of reluctant with Arabic. Our parents had given us workbooks. They had tried really hard to make us learn. And I mean, we were kids and we were bratty and we didn't understand. And so we really, like, I think it was when we got there, it was just kind of embarrassing for us that we couldn't communicate. It was, I mean, it's awkward, right? Like, people are having a conversation, you're sitting there and you're just excluded, not because of anything, but the fact that you don't speak the language that they speak. And I think that that was kind of a wake-up call for us. And after that, I think partially through increased exposure of going to visit our family in the Middle East, and partially out of like kind of an increased awareness of the importance of the language, we both, I think my brother and I both kind of started to prioritize Arabic more in our lives. We both took in undergrad. I mean, it's tough to say. I think as much as I would like to think that any human can have a genuine connection with another human, that connection is going to be maybe on a more superficial level if you can't genuinely exchange with them. Conversation in another person's language is just a really incredible way to show that you have a respect for them and a respect for their culture, and that you are open and kind of prepared, I guess, to understand them on a genuine level. I think a lot of times I think about work that Americans or Westerners do in other countries in the kind of development space, and I'm shocked to find out just how many of them haven't really asked the people who live in a community like what they want or what they need.
Yeah.
They literally don't speak the language that they speak, and it's frustrating. It's like, it makes, I think it really has me question the kind of intentions of the work that's being done.
That is something I wrestle with a lot too, of when you look at just like service projects and global development projects of Westerners coming into these kinds of spaces. It feels like modern day colonialism, because like you said, like they're not speaking the language, and they are going there for like self-fulfillment of wanting to like learn something about themselves and like feel good as a humanitarian, but not like actively speaking with the local community of like, okay, what do you actually need? How can I help you become a better citizen in your own country and advocate for yourself? I think also just like knowing other languages and being able to speak that with other people, it's just such a joyful experience because it makes them feel less like an outsider, but it also is like, hey, like I am here for you. You're not alone in this. And there's another point of access that is far more genuine, like you were saying. And so what has your experience been like working with the Baraka English School and going back to Iraq and trying to navigate the kind of the flexible boundaries of language differences in non-Western spaces? How do you feel like you and your brother are doing differently that has been more successful?
Yeah. You know, I think the main thing that I kind of credit to the work that we're doing is that our relationship has been a pretty long-term one with, so basically, Barca, the way that it works is that we partnered with an organization called Mu'assasat al-Yatim al-Khayriya, which just is Orphan Charity Foundation in English. And so the way that it all started is that we were heading over there and teaching kind of just like English boot camps, you could say, like a free week-long course, a free two-week-long course for the students, because English is in their curriculum, so you can just kind of take it as like it was kind of an extracurricular or like summer camp type thing. And our relationship with them kind of evolved over time. And so I think that the first thing that I would say is that I didn't just show up and say, this is what we're going to do. It was rather, we had this relationship with the folks at Orphan Charity Foundation for several years. For 3 years, we were going and teaching, and then kind of our idea of what could be offered over there evolved. And so I think that that's definitely one thing. And then the second thing is, I think I try my best to be flexible to what their needs are. So something that I remember, I had this conversation with, her name is Om Ibrahim. She's the kind of director of this branch of the foundation. And I remember I was having a conversation with her about kind of my kind of learning approach, teaching approach, what I think is important, and how I didn't want the courses that at this point we were talking about really having these like weekly instruction courses with Barca. And I was saying, I don't want them to be learning for the test. I want them to learn so that they can obtain a competency in English that allow them to communicate. Really, like, I was kind of saying I want it kind of along the lines of how I approach language, if that makes sense, which is, yeah, I want to be able to connect with people and communicate with people. And she looked at me and she laughed and she was like, no. She was like, I mean, that would be great, but these kids are not passing the test. And if they can't pass the test, there's really no point in the work that, in this work. And she said to me, these students, like, English is such a barrier for their continuing their education, because it's kind of one of the tougher subjects for them to get a passing score in these cumulative end of the year exams that are so important in Iraq. And she said, I mean, that's lovely that you think that, but that's not what they need. And And I think that that was a big turning point for me too, and kind of understanding that sometimes you need to start with just the survival in this education system, like their kind of posturing. I mean, these are orphans who come from like pretty vulnerable, especially socioeconomic backgrounds. And so their posturing within the education system is not like that of me, who was lucky enough to go to private school, was like a student at Emory, who it was never really a question, I think, growing up, if I would stay in school or drop out. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think kind of reshifting my gears to listening to what they had to say about what these students really needed was really important. And I think it wouldn't be possible to have that conversation if it hadn't been this like long-term type of relationship.
That reminds me a lot of a reading I did for one of my classes where we were talking about how that sometimes it's ideal when you think about social change and social action, sometimes it's hard to forget that one of the most like pivotal seminal goals is just a call to survive. It's not, sometimes you can't get to the point of like cultural and social revolution if people are just struggling to survive.
Yeah.
And I think that applies a lot to what you were just saying about having to survive in the educational system. Of English is this barrier for so many children of, okay, if you don't pass this exam, like you can get held back, or your entire experience in the education system is radically altered. And so how do you feel like this connects to the broader like education movements happening in the Middle East right now? Of where do you feel that competency and working fluency and conversational language falls into place of just educational reform movements in the Middle East, but also just like in non-Western spaces at large?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, something that I think I've thought about a lot recently in my kind of assessment of the situation is that testing, I mean, across the board, Western countries, non-Western countries, is there's too much kind of emphasis and there are too many stakes placed on testing. And I think even when considering just how educational systems are valued or like how they're assessed, really one of the biggest standards for educational quality is a score on something called the PISA test. And really, I mean, I think that this creates some problems, right? Because I know in particular in the Middle East, there's a text called Education in the Arab World, edited by Sarah Kurdar, that really kind of hones in on the fact that in the Middle East, there's too much emphasis on rote memorization. And that, I attribute at least in part to the fact that in these countries, in Iraq, I can say for sure, there are these tests at the end of the year that really are a typical standardized tests. And if you can learn how to take the test, then you can learn how to succeed. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you're hitting the correct, like the educational kind of milestones that you need to be.
Yeah.
I think in light of COVID, I've been interested in seeing how some of these tests have been waived. And I'm curious about how different systems are going to be adapting, considering the way the kind of waiver of tests. I know in Iraq this year, the kind of cumulative test was waived due to COVID. In the US, we're seeing how certain universities are already waiving SAT, ACT requirements. I'm really hopeful, I think, at this time that schooling systems can take this moment where they have a year where the test is not kind of part of the picture to rediscover how to kind of evaluate their students. I'm excited about that. I'm hopeful about that. And at the same time, I'm a little bit pessimistic because I feel sometimes that the way that we measure is so wrapped up in testing that there's no way out. And the systems, like especially kind of like Korean, Japanese systems that are so revered on the global stage, are also so heavily wrapped up in this high stakes testing that it's going to be challenging to kind of extract ourselves from it. But
multicultural and multilingual and interfaith dialogues important to you? And what do you think can be gained from cultivating these spaces and trying to foster more embracing spaces?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think in my life, because I think in part because I really have never been in a community that, I mean, for a long time now, I haven't been in a community that's just like me. I haven't, I guess, had the privilege to just have, I guess, the validation that maybe comes, because I think that there is value, right, to having communities of people who are just like you.
Yeah.
Especially when it's, like not necessarily just your family, right? Like I think especially I've talked to a lot of my friends about the power of spaces exclusively for Black people, exclusively for persons of color. And those spaces, I think a lot of times can be ones of healing, of connection. And I think that those are very powerful ones. That being said, I think I, just my particular case, have not really been in a setting where I've been able to be in this like homogenous, like me kind of area. And so I think I have really fed into the cultivation of very diverse spaces. I think it's partially because due to my upbringing and where I've been at Emory and where I've been in Alabama, my kind of social circle has been very diverse to the extent that sometimes it's not, I wouldn't say disorienting, but sometimes I'm like a little overwhelmed by all of the difference, I guess.
Yeah.
Comes with the people that I love and I'm very close to. And I think a lot of people I've noticed don't get to have those kind of explicitly diverse interfaith spaces, multicultural spaces, multilingual spaces. They're just not exposed to them for a variety of reasons. And so I think for me, it's been really important to make those in the ways that I can to bring people together. I think one of my favorite experiences at Emory was coordinating the Interfaith Coalition dinner series, and in particular, and one of our partner organizations, the Muslim Students Association, did a dinner that brought together, I think like 6 or 7 other faith-based organizations, all in one room to kind of reflect on spring faith traditions. And I just remember looking around the room and thinking, like, this should happen more at a school like Emory that is so diverse, that has these different groups, right? And our communities really have so much to gain from each other by identifying our sameness and our difference at this, you know, like all at the same time. And I think I've just been really inspired by times in which that can be pulled off, because it's really challenging to create truly inclusive spaces that are free and accessible to all. So I just think we have a lot to learn from one another. And whenever we can get together in that way, it's good.
Yeah, totally. I think also, like, in my own, like you, like, I grew up in very, like, diverse spaces. And it was weird to, like, also not see myself in those spaces, but I couldn't relate to people being in like a homogenous environment because I didn't grow up in that, right? And so I feel like having interfaith dialogues has, I mean, there's multiple goals of it, like 100%, but I also think, at least for my experience of being a part of them but also leading them, has been like, okay, how do we make sure people don't become complacent in homogeneousness? How do we continue to like help people understand the value of inclusive and diverse spaces, and spaces like in like that can be like a building but also like communities and just like social media feeds and like all these different kind of metaphysical and physical spaces. But I think also like so much of these international global human rights issues, I feel that they often are wrongly perceived or wrongly represented because we don't have this like knowledge of the values that of like peace and reconciliation can happen in having interfaith dialogues. If you don't know about, okay, this other religion that I'm not a part of, you may not understand or be able to rebuild, but assist in the efforts to heal a specific community. And I think that's when issues of stereotyping arises, of not having the knowledge for whatever reason. I don't think it's like the fault of anyone in particular. I think more the lack of like interfaith dialogue isn't necessarily because of ignorance. I think it's just of how the system has been designed for so long. But there, I have learned so much about myself and having these conversations with people of different faith backgrounds and of different international groups. There is a certain, like, it goes back down to empathy, and that is such a fundamental part of the human condition, of just empathizing with other people for the sake of just loving on someone else, not for another reason, whether that's personal gain or to feel like more assured of, like, I'm a global citizen because I have a diverse friend group. But it just changes the how you yourself engage with the world, but also how you occupy your own space and how you perceive yourself of it just changes your own personal and broader cultural narrative.
I completely agree with that. And I think the other thing too, right, is I think that in particularly in my experience in the US, I think people give identity politics a bad rep. And it's unfair sometimes, because I think the way that we really should be using identity politics, I guess, is to actively seek out the experiences and the kind of worldview perspectives of others. And I don't think that humans can kind of understand what kind of perspective maybe they're missing in their worldview unless people are outward about the world, unless people are talking about it openly. And it's not political, it's not something divisive or anything like that, right? It doesn't need to be, and I think a lot of times religion in particular is weaponized in a really unfortunate way, where people talk about religion in kind of a in pursuit of converting other people, or they have an agenda in which they want, they're not kind of engaging in these conversations in earnest out of a curiosity of understanding somebody else and why they might think differently, or why they might think the exact same, but come at it in a slightly different way. They're engaging in these conversations for the wrong reasons. And I don't know, I think a lot of times I'm always really, really curious to hear about why people think the way they think. What about their culture is different than mine? What is painful for them, or what is happy for them? And how we can kind of create these spaces. And I mean, really, I think a lot about representation and what when there is a diverse pool of people, like, what should a team look like? What should classes look like? What should clubs look like? You know? I think that there needs to be intention to make those places inclusive and diverse and empowering for everybody involved. And sometimes that just, I mean, it requires an explicit discussion about identity, about race, about class and religion, that I think a lot of people are just uncomfortable with. And I wish they weren't so uncomfortable with it sometimes, because it's just the kind of crux of who we are. So.
Yeah, absolutely. I think also, like, what you were saying about how religion gets weaponized and identity doesn't always, it's not always as political as people make it out to be. Mm-hmm. And I think the innate curiosity of just is such like a, that's also just like a, I feel like a fundamental part of the human condition, is we are curious beings. And we, I think if we shut that off, if we don't keep that light on, you lose so much of the beauty in the world. And I think also you were talking about how people often come into religious spaces of trying to convert people, and I think that's also, it's a big part of like evangelical, like Christianity, which is like a whole other like concept that I won't go into. But I think what a lot of people also forget, that like there is a historical precedence in religion, that if you perceive these sacred texts as historical documents, so much is gained from that, right? Of mm-hmm. I think people are drawn to religion for like comfort and to find some kind of validity of emotion. Mm-hmm. And I think if people like step back and like don't make religion and identity political, I think so much is learned about, okay, how do I talk to people who like don't agree with me?
Mm-hmm.
How do I have really diverse spaces and conversations, and how do I make that a part of my everyday life? And that value of intentionality is something that like really rung home with what you were just saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. And I also think too, it's about letting go of like hierarchies of values and backgrounds, I guess.
Yeah.
In that sometimes I think that we just need to go into spaces and just see what people have to say, as opposed to feeling like we need to go into spaces to justify our own belief system. Because I think that can get really problematic as well, in that, I mean, religion doesn't have to be a competition.
You know, yes. Religion
doesn't have to be a competition. I mean, same for culture really as well. I think a lot of times I kind of struggle with comparisons of different cultures or different places, as though in this way that kind of sets the ground as a battlefield where like it's always going to be a clash of cultures. It's always going to
yes.
be a clash of like who has the best food, who has the best clothing, who has like the best kind of practices. Whereas really, I mean, all of these things are just so dynamic, and we would like to be able to just study them in a textbook or go to one visit or go to speak to one person from a different faith background and think that we know enough to kind of
yeah.
Whereas I wish people would just kind of view it as a learning process about other people and how they kind of approach going through life.
I think also like there are people who fall in like two categories in interfaith dialogues. If you have people who are curious and wanting to learn more and aren't quite sure of what this means or what that means, or mm-hmm. just trying to see clarity. But then there are the people on the other side who are grounded in their beliefs and their values and their faith traditions and spiritual practices and all of these things. And so what has it been like for you to enter these dialogues as a Muslim, and how have you embodied your own beliefs in these dialogues and just the variety of communities you engage in?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the biggest things that I have taken from my religious education is just how important knowledge is. I genuinely do believe that knowledge is power, and that teaching and learning is just they're just some of the most powerful acts that we can engage in. I think when I consider my kind of role in building these dialogues, I think what I kind of thrive in doing, I guess, is building a coalition.
If
you want to get the right people in the room. I mean, sometimes, of course, it's a complete and total failure and it doesn't work out. It's awkward, or it's not the right people end up coming, not the right people end up buying in, or too much of one type of person ends up buying in, if the kind of, I would say, like the table isn't set right. But I think that's what's most important to me, just kind of creating the space, because I think that conversations end up happening pretty naturally.
Where do you feel like you get to express yourself freely in the ways you were just describing? Is there certain moments or certain people or certain places where you feel more grounded in your identity and in your beliefs and values, and obviously among other things, but where do you feel yourself just most rooted and grounded in your and who you are in your being?
You know, I think that I show parts. I think this is what is a little bit odd, maybe, is that sometimes I feel like I show parts of myself to different people. And it's not that I am walking around and there are like six of me. I think it's more so that there are many different kind of parts of my life that have made me into who I am. And sometimes those communities have felt so different that it is hard to kind of bring them together. And there really aren't a lot of, there's like so few people in the overlap, I guess I would say. And so I think that I have just been really lucky to have found really incredible people in my life, in academic circles and social circles, and my family, that I can truly feel myself around. Although I think that that the like kind of version of myself maybe varies a little bit from community to community. And I think more recently I've found my peace with that. It doesn't feel disorienting anymore, whereas I think it did for some time.
How have you sort of integrated these questions and these thoughts that you've brought up, but also just in things that you shared with me in the past, of how have you sort of had to navigate bringing this into academic spaces as opposed to like a community experience, or if you do go back to Iraq, or a variety of things? How has integrating like your personal work and just like your existence as who you are and different kind of activist notions that you are a part of, how has that been to bring that into an academic space that is in the past has not been known to be a super like fruit bearing environment for just, I don't know, not the intellectual outskirts, but just the things that aren't like the thoughts and ideas that are challenging existing or preconceived notions of identity and cultural experience?
Yeah, and I think at Emory in particular, I think when I came to Emory, I was a little bit taken aback because growing up in Alabama, my kind of perspective and political opinions, I think at times were overwhelmingly liberal or progressive to some people. And then I come here and I think on the spectrum of political opinions, a lot of people kind of understood me to be moderate, which I found interesting. And maybe more entirely, and it's funny because in very liberal spaces like Emory, moderate is an insult. But I don't.
Yeah,
yeah, I know. I laugh about it, but I don't really think I'm moderate. I think what I try to do is, my opinion aside, is in class settings in particular, I try to bring up, especially when I think we hit this kind of default echo chamber situation in a discussion course, I generally try to bring up the kind of perspective that is valid but has not been brought up. I think that that's really important. I actually think that we all need to be, especially in spaces like ours, I mean, not bringing up the racist, bigoted perspectives, but bringing up the valid kind of intellectually grounded ones that are counter to what many of us believe or agree on in the classroom. I don't think that discussion is fruitful if we don't actively try to draw those out and engage with them. Well, I think in the kind of academic space, I often think about, there's kind of like what I think, there's what people that I grew up with here in the South think. Southerners, like white Christian Republican, kind of that demographic, what I know from conversations for them to think, what more maybe conservative members in the Muslim community think, what maybe I, in conversations with my family in Iraq, have understood. I think really when you're evaluating something, considering deeply and rationalizing those different kinds of perspectives before arriving to your own, I think has been really important for me and grounded me in, and I think in some ways also kind of like liberated me from feeling like there's one way or there's one path to live or to govern or to lead. I think that that's been important for me too.
That's so beautiful. Oh my gosh. Aww. I guess my summarizing question, think about young Miriam.
Mm-hmm.
What would you tell her to bring comfort to what is going to come for her life of wrestling with all of these issues of, okay, moving, being in an immigrant family, not being as fluent in the language that is of your home and of your family? What would you tell her or even other young people who are Arab American youth? What would you tell them to comfort them and encourage them for what's to come of their future?
Probably say, I've been thinking about this recently, about, I think just being back in Alabama especially has made me kind of reflect on my time here and how much I've grown, thankfully, from my time here. And I think what I would probably tell myself is that you can be your own kind of guiding compass, and there does not need to be, nor should you necessarily expect to find someone to be there as your kind of concrete role model for the things that you want to do, because you're not really going to be able to find somebody exactly like that. Or maybe I will, and it'll be a while from now. But until then, I think I would tell myself to just believe that that the path doesn't have to be paved yet by anybody, and you can pave it yourself. I think would be the main thing that I would tell myself, because I think for a long time I felt so overwhelmed by not seeing a person who was doing the things that I wanted to do, not seeing kind of like a concrete linear professional track for the type of work that I wanted to do. And I think it made me feel like maybe what I was doing wasn't valid at times. Especially, I think, when I consider kind of like political activism work, storytelling, some of the work that I've done in Iraq, I think sometimes it's maybe better for the path not to be paved, so that you don't have to just, you don't have to work towards a standard. You can work towards whatever you think is right. So.
Yes.
That's
I love that.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode. You can learn more about the project at grayschoolmovement.org, and that's gray with an A. And check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter while you're at it. Talk to you soon. Bye.